Hey guys, Tim, alcoholic.
Hey, Tim.
Tonight we are on page 258. This is our ninth week of a 10-week cycle, even though it does say story number 8 there, because it does not give Dr. Bob's nightmare a number, so it's sort of separate, and the reason for that is they're calling him the co-founder. So these subsequent 8 stories have all been pioneers very early in our history. Tonight is He Sold Himself Short. This is the story of Earl Treat. He originally came in September of 37, in for a few months, goes back out for a very short period of time and comes back in, ultimately gets sober early to mid-38 and stays sober his whole life. His story does not appear in the first edition. It appears in the second edition, and we'll see that later on in the text. And he is referred to in the first 164, and when we get to that point, we'll go back and see that just so we can sort of, you know, dovetail them together. He is the founder of AA Chicago. He, you know, got sober, and, you know, Bill and Bob sent him off back to Chicago and said, okay, set this thing up there. You know, he had... you know, whatever, 3 weeks sobriety or whatever. And he does discuss some of the history of that. And so that's a major part about him. And probably a more important thing is actually he, I believe, is the first person to push Bill Wilson into codifying the AA experience at the group level, i.e. the traditions. So he comes in. Obviously, traditions are not done until 1950, but they had a history prior to that, and it started in 1946. Bill started to write what he ultimately called the 12 Points to Assure Our Future, which was 12 traditions. And so we see very closely to what they were in the long form at the back of the book of the traditions, written about in the grapevine and ultimately then got voted on at our first international conference and got ratified, so hence the traditions then. Okay, so there's a little background. Again, 258. But he found there was a higher power that had more faith in him than he had in himself. Thus, AA was born in Chicago. So there's the reference to him being a founder. I grew up in a small town outside Akron, Ohio, where the life was typical of any average small town. I was very much interested in athletics, and because of this and parental influence, I didn't drink or smoke in either grade or high school. All of this changed when I went to college. I had to adapt to new associations and associates, and it seemed to me the smart thing to drink and smoke. I confined drinking to weekends and drank normally in college and for several years thereafter. After I left school, I went to work in Akron, living at home with my parents. Home life was again a restraining influence. When I drank, I hid it from my folks out of respect for their feelings. This continued until I was 27. Then I started traveling with the United States and Canada as my territory, and with so much freedom and with an unlimited expense account, I was soon drinking every night and kidding myself that it was all part of the job. So here he's already progressed, you know, sometime after age 27 to drinking every night, and already knows that he's delusional, that he's calling it as part of his job. I know now that 60% of the time I drank alone without benefit of customers. In 1930, I moved to Chicago. Shortly thereafter, aided by the Depression, I found that I had a great deal of spare time and that a little drink in the morning helped. By 1932, I was going on 2 or 3 day benders. That same year, my wife became fed up with my drinking around the house and called my dad in Akron to come and pick me up. Earl's wife's name is Katie. She asked him to do something about me because she couldn't. She was thoroughly disgusted. This was the beginning of 5 years of bouncing back and forth between my home in Chicago and Akron to sober up. Now remember, he's not going to Akron to sober up with Dr. Bob. This is pre that. This is going back to the family house. It was a period of binges coming closer and closer together and being of longer duration. Once, Dad came all the way to Florida to sober me up after a hotel manager called him and said that if he wanted to see me alive, he better get there fast. So we see the progression. My wife could not understand why I would sober up for Dad, but not for her. They went into a huddle, and Dad explained that he simply took my pants, shoes, and money away so that I could get no liquor and had to sober up. One time, my wife decided to try this too. After finding every bottle that I had hidden around the apartment, she took away my pants, my shoes, my money, and my keys, threw them under the bed in the back bedroom, and slip-locked our door. By 1 a.m., I was desperate, so he needed a drink now, right? I found some wool stockings, some white flannels that had shrunk to my knees, and an old jacket. I jimmied the front door so that I could get back in and walked out. I was hit by an icy blast. It was February with snow and ice on the ground, and I had a 4-block walk to the nearest cab stand, but I made it. On my ride to the nearest bar, I sold the driver on how misunderstood I was by my wife and what an unreasonable person she was. By the time we reached the bar, he was willing to buy me a quart with his own money. Then, when we got back to the apartment, he was willing to wait 2 or 3 days until I got my health back to be paid off for the liquor and fare. I was a good salesman. My wife could not understand the next morning why I was drunker than the night before when she had taken my bottles. After a particularly bad Christmas and New Year's holiday, Dad picked me up again early in January 1937 to go through the usual sobering up routine. This consisted of walking the floor for 3 or 4 days and nights until I could take nourishment. This time he had a suggestion to offer. He waited until I was completely sober. That's a suggestion from the big book, right? And on the day before I was to head back for Chicago, he told me of a small group of men in Akron who apparently had the same problem that I had, but were doing something about it. He said they were sober, happy, and had their self-respect back, as well as the respect of their neighbors. He mentioned 2 of them whom I had known through the years and suggested that I talk with them. But I had my health back, and besides, I reasoned, they were much worse than I would ever be. Why, even a year ago, I had seen Howard, an ex-doctor, mooching a dime for a drink. I could not possibly be that bad. I would have at least asked for a quarter. So I told Dad that I would lick it on my own, that I would drink nothing for a month, and after that, only beer. Several months later, Dad was back in Chicago to pick me up again, but this time my attitude was entirely different. So here he is, he's hit his bottom, his bottom. So he's gonna recognize that he's hopeless at this thing. He's not gonna have self-will to get himself through this. He can't lick it on his own. I could not wait to tell him that I wanted help, that if these men in Akron had anything, I wanted it and would do anything to get it. I was completely licked by alcohol. This is the correct state of mind to receive the message now. I can still remember very distinctly getting into Akron at 11 p.m. and routing this same Howard out of bed to do something about me. He spent 2 hours with me that night telling me his story. So here's the reminder all the time, and I love when I see this. It reminds me, we don't go and tell them their story. We're not grilling them. Our first encounters with people is us telling our story. He said he had finally learned that drinking was a fatal illness made up of an allergy plus an obsession, so physical, mental. And once the drinking had passed from habit to obsession, we were completely hopeless and could look forward only to spending the balance of our lives in mental institutions or to death. And we say in the rooms all the time, what's your three choices? Jails, institutions, or death. So it's just missing jails there, right? He laid great stress on the progression of his attitude toward life and people. And most of his attitudes had been very similar to mine. I thought at times that he was telling my story. I had thought that I was completely different from other people, that I was beginning to become a little balmy, even to the point of withdrawing more and more from society and wanting to be alone with my bottle. Here was a man with essentially the same outlook on life, except that he had done something about it. He was happy, getting a kick out of life and people, and beginning to get his medical practice back again. As I look back on that first evening, I realize that I began to hope then for the first time, and I felt that if he could regain these things, perhaps it would be possible for me too. The next afternoon and evening, two other men visited me, and each told me his story and the things that they were doing to try to recover from this tragic illness. They had that certain something that seemed to glow, a peace, a serenity combined with happiness. In the next 2 or 3 days, the balance of this handful of men contacted me, encouraged me, and told me how they were trying to live this program of recovery and the fun they were having doing it. Then, and only then, after a thorough indoctrination by 8 or 9 individuals, was I allowed to attend my first meeting. So 8 or 9 individuals is the total number of people that were sober within the program at the time for Akron. And what's really great about seeing this is almost like pre-qualifying the client. Right, you're going to sell somebody something. You want to make sure that they actually can afford the product you're selling. Do they actually need it? Do we need to create the need for them? This is sales 101, right? So their success rate goes way up. And 8 or 9 people have already talked to this guy, so they've kind of looked at each other and said, "Okay, is this a viable candidate?" And obviously, somebody said yes, or multiple people said yes. This first meeting was held in the living room of a home. And was led by Bill Dotson, AA number 3, the first man that Bill W. and Dr. Bob had worked with successfully, the man on the bed. The meeting consisted of perhaps 8 or 9 alcoholics and 7 or 8 wives. It was different from the meetings now held. The big AA book had not been written, and there was no literature except various religious pamphlets. The program was carried on entirely by word of mouth. The meeting lasted an hour and closed with the Lord's Prayer. After it closed, we all retired to the kitchen and had coffee and donuts. There'd be a riot here, wouldn't there be, if you couldn't have your coffee first? Retired to the kitchen and had coffee and donuts and more discussion until the small hours of the morning. Now remember, they're only meeting like this sort of quasi-official meeting, once a week. Watch what they do every other night of the week. I was terribly impressed by this meeting and the quality of happiness these men displayed, despite their lack of material means. In this small group during the Depression, there was no one who was not hard up. And remember, these are all professional families. Due to the Depression and where they are in the Midwest, they're affected greatly. I stayed in Akron 2 or 3 weeks on my initial trip, trying to absorb as much of the program and philosophy as possible. I spent a great deal of time with Dr. Bob whenever he had the time to spare, and in the homes of 2 or 3 other people, trying to see how the family lived the program. Here it is. Every evening, we would meet at the home of one of the members and have coffee and donuts and spend a social evening. The day before I was to go back to Chicago, so how long was he there? 2 to 3 weeks. So watch what he does now, because I use this on sponsees all the time. The day before I was due to go back to Chicago, it was Dr. Bob's afternoon off. He had me to the office, and we spent 3 or 4 hours formally going through the 6-step program as it was at that time. So he did all of the steps in his first 2 or 3 weeks, right? And wouldn't we call that, knowing that you, most of you guys have sat through this whole cycle, in Bill's story, all done in detox, Dr. Bob, it's not in Dr. Bob's Nightmare, it's in the book Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. Dr. Bob does it like the same day. He drank that morning, did the surgery to fix the problem of the surgery he had done prior, and had done many of his ninth step amends that same day. Then we saw our Earl Treat, 2 to 3 weeks. So everybody does their steps much faster than we do, right? We've sort of said, yeah, you know, you've been here 4 years. Okay, get started now. So here's the 6 steps before the big book is written. Here's the 6 steps that Bill converts into 12. It's the same. This 6 is in here. He just broke it up so that you couldn't get too weaselly out of anything, right? So 1, complete the deflation. 2, dependence and guidance from a higher power. 3, moral inventory. 4, confession. 5, restitution. 6, continued work with other alcoholics. So what I did, I wrote the corresponding step or steps next to each one. So here it is. Complete deflation, step 1. Dependence and guidance from a higher power, steps 2, 3, and 11. Moral inventory, 4 and 10. Confession, 5, 6, and 7. Restitution, 8 and 9. And continued work with other alcoholics, 12. Dr. Bob led me through all of these steps. At the moral inventory, he brought up several of my bad personality traits or character defects, such as selfishness, conceit, jealousy, carelessness, intolerance, ill temper, sarcasm, and resentments. We went over these at great length, and then he finally asked me if I wanted these defects of character removed. So in other words, he doesn't say, are you not going to do those things anymore? Do you want someone else to remove them because you're powerless over them? Right? We have to ask the power to remove them. When I said yes, we both knelt at his desk and prayed, each of us asking to have these defects taken away. So look at that. Both sponsor and sponsee are both praying for the same thing. Dr. Bob praying that Earl Treat have these defects removed from him. The power of two there. This picture is still vivid. If I live to be 100, it will always stand out in my mind. It was very impressive, and I wish that every AA could have the benefit of this type of sponsorship today. Dr. Bob always emphasized the religious angle very strongly, and I think it helped. I know it helped me. Dr. Bob then led me through the restitution step, in which I made a list of the persons I had harmed. That's 8. But now watch what the verbiage is here. And worked out the ways and means of slowly making restitution. So when we give out that 8-step list, that one that you guys have seen us here, that is, it. Who do I owe it to? What do I owe it for? And what the hell am I going to do? Because you're going to forget in 3 years. You didn't see Johnny and you owed him the 20 and I don't know. And it's written down so you can always refer back to it. Or like, oh, I didn't get to that yet. I got to be able to cross that one off. It's good to have it written down. I made several decisions at that time. One of them was that I would try to get a group started in Chicago. The second was that I would have to return to Akron to attend meetings at least every 2 months until I did get a group started in Chicago. Third, I decided I must place this program above everything else, even my family, because if I did not maintain my sobriety, I would lose my family anyway. If I did not maintain my sobriety, I would not have a job. If I did not maintain my sobriety, I would have no friends left. I had few enough at that time. The next day, I went back to Chicago and started a vigorous campaign among my so-called friends or drinking companions. Their answer was always the same. If they needed it at any time, they would surely get in touch with me. I went to a minister and a doctor whom I still knew, and they, in turn, asked me how long I had been sober. When I told them 6 weeks, They were polite and said that they would contact me in case they had anyone with an alcoholic problem. Needless to say, it was a year or more before they did contact me. On my trips back to Akron to get my spirits recharged and to work with other alcoholics, I would ask Dr. Bob about this delay and wonder just what was wrong with me. He would invariably reply, "When you are right and the time is right, Providence will provide. You must always be willing and continue to make contacts." A few months after I made my original trip to Akron, I was feeling pretty cocky, and I didn't think my wife was treating me with proper respect now that I was an outstanding citizen. So I set out to get drunk deliberately, just to teach her what she was missing. So this is where, so I believe I mentioned in the beginning that he came in 37 and ultimately gets sober in 38, early to mid 38. And this is the reference here. Let's turn back to page 135. So he's talking about having a few months and ultimately from resentment, because he's saying his wife wasn't treating him right. And we know resentments are the number one offender. Let's turn to page 135. And this is in the family afterward, second paragraph. This is some more detail to that experience. This is about Earl Treat. Here is a case in point. One of our friends is a heavy smoker and coffee drinker. There was no doubt he overindulged. Seeing this and meaning to be helpful, his wife commenced to admonish him about it. He admitted he was overdoing these things, but frankly said he was not ready to stop. His wife is one of those persons who really feels there is something rather sinful about these commodities, so she nagged, and her intolerance finally threw him into a fit of anger. He got drunk. Of course our friend was wrong, dead wrong. He had to painfully admit that and mend his spiritual fences. Though he is now a most effective member of Alcoholics Anonymous, he still smokes and drinks coffee. But neither his wife nor anyone else stands in judgment. She sees he was wrong to, she was wrong to make a burning issue out of such a matter when his more serious ailments were being rapidly cured. So that's the reference back to Earl. A week back to 264. Bottom of the page, last three lines. A week later, I got to get an old friend from Akron to spend 2 days sobering me up. I got to read that again. I'm sorry. I didn't like that. A week later, I had to get an old friend from Akron to spend 2 days sobering me up. That was my lesson, that one could not take the moral inventory and then file it away, meaning step four, that the alcoholic has to continue to take inventory every day if he expects to get well and stay well, meaning step 10. That was my only slip. It taught me a valuable lesson. In the summer of 1938, almost a year from the time I made my original contact with Akron, the man for whom I was working and who knew about the program approached me and asked if I could do anything about one of his salesmen who was drinking very heavily. I went to the sanitarium where this chap was incarcerated and found to my surprise that he was interested. He had been waiting to do something about his drinking for a long time, but did not know how. I spent several days with him, but I did not feel adequate to pass the program on to him by myself. So I suggested that he take a trip to Akron for a couple of weeks, which he did, living with one of the AA families there. So we're talking about Dick R. here. This is his first success in Chicago. Goes down to Akron, comes back, works closely with Earl from that point on. When he returned, we had practically daily meetings from that time on. A few months later, one of the men who had been in touch with the group in Akron came to Chicago to live, and then there were three of us who continued to have informal meetings quite regularly. And this is, AA Chicago, AA3 Chicago is Ken A. In spring of 1939, the big book was printed, and we had two inquiries from the New York office because of a 15-minute radio talk that was made. That's that Gabriel Heater radio broadcast. Neither one of the two was interested for himself, one being a mother who wanted to do something for her son. I suggested to her that she should see the son's minister or doctor, and that perhaps he would recommend the AA program. The doctor, a young man, immediately took fire with the idea, and while he did not convince the son, he turned over two prospects who were anxious for the program. The three of us did not feel up to the job. And after a few meetings, we convinced the prospects that they too should go to Akron, where they could see an older group in action. In the meantime, another doctor in Evanston became convinced that the program had possibilities and turned over a woman to us to do something about. She was full of enthusiasm and also made the trip to Akron. So they're talking about Sylvia Kaufman here, and that's next week's story, Keys of the Kingdom. She worked intimately with Earl. In fact, she gets the credit of being the first intergroup secretary outside of big cities. They call them central offices. So the first intergroup secretary, don't confuse that with the AA, the Alcoholic Foundation back in New York. First intergroup secretary. Immediately on her return in the autumn of 1939, we began to have formal meetings once a week, and we have continued to do this and to expand ever since. Occasionally, it is accorded to a few of us to watch something fine grow from a tiny kernel into something of gigantic goodness. Such has been my privilege, both nationally and in my home city. From a mere handful in Akron, we have spread throughout the world. From a single member in the Chicago area commuting to Akron, we now exceed 6,000. So he's writing this around 1955, right? These last 18 years, so you do the math there, right? So approximately 1938, 1955. These last 18 years have been the happiest of my life. Trite though that statement may seem. 15 of those years I would not have enjoyed had I continued drinking. Doctors told me before I stopped that I had only 3 years at the outside to live. This latest part of my life has had a purpose, not in great things accomplished, but in daily living. Courage to face each day has replaced the fears and uncertainties of earlier years. Acceptance of things as they are has replaced the old and patient champing at the bit to conquer the world. I have stopped tilting at windmills and instead have tried to accomplish the little daily tasks, unimportant in themselves, but tasks that are integral part of living fully. When derision, that's mockery, when derision, contempt, and pity were once shown me, I now enjoy the respect of many people. Where once I had I had casual acquaintances, all of whom were fair weather friends, I now have a host of friends who accept me for what I am. And over my AA years, I have made many real, honest, sincere friendships that I shall always cherish. I am rated as a modestly successful man. My stock of material goods isn't great, but I have a fortune in friendships, courage, self-assurance, and honest appraisal of my own abilities. Above all, I have gained the greatest thing accorded to any man, the love and understanding of a gracious God who has lifted me from the alcoholic scrap heap to a position of trust where I've been able to reap the rich rewards that come from showing a little love for others and from serving them as I can. We're going to end there tonight.